المؤمنين، هل رأيت ربك حين عبدته؟ وعلي، have you seen your Lord when you worship him? And the answer came even more surprising. ويلك ما كنت أعبد ربا لم أره. Ali says to this person, what do you think? Am I going to worship somebody whom I don't see? So the answer was even more confusing than the question. Because he says, I'm not going to worship somebody I do not see. And so this follow-up question came up. كيف رأيته? How did you see your Lord? This is where Amir al-Mu'minin now clarifies the reality. He says, ويلك لا تدركه العيون في مشاهدة الأبصار. The eyes cannot see him face to face. ولكن رعته القلوب بحقائق الإيمان. The hearts are able to perceive him through the realities of belief and Iman. Ali is saying, open the eyes of your heart. This is where you'll be able to see the Jamal and the beauty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not through these eyes. And then he goes and talks about him in detail where he says, he is closer to you, but not in a sense that you can touch him. He is far away from you, but not in the sense that he is separate from you. So Amir al-Mu'mineen reached to that level of spiritual, you know, stage where he was able to see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the eyes of his heart, not by this vision of the eyes. And that is where you see he utters the words where he says, مَا رَعَيْتُ شَيْئًا, that I had never seen anything. إِلَّا رَعَيْتُ رَعَيْتُ اللَّهَ قَبْلُهُ وَبَعَدُهُ وَمَعَهُ. He says, I don't see anything but that I see Allah before it and after it and with it. There is no moment in my life where I forget Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The consciousness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was there always with Amir al-Mu'mineen. And that is why he on one hand becomes Waliyul Awliya, and on the other hand he becomes Waliyullah, the beloved of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. Official statistics show that Muslims are the most targeted group in the UK, with nearly 3,500 hate crimes perpetrated against Muslims in England and Wales last year. So on today's show, we're going to ask why Islamophobia is reaching epidemic proportions and what can be done about it.
On the 29th of March, around 11 p.m., an elderly Muslim man walking home from his local masjid was viciously attacked by three men. The unprovoked assault left the 73-year-old victim hospitalized with a broken hand and multiple cuts to the face. The incident is just the latest example of an all-too-common event in Britain, Islamophobic hate crimes. The UK has a severe problem with anti-Muslim discrimination. Unchecked political rhetoric, combined with hostile media coverage, has created fear and mistrust, the seeds which breed hatred of the close to 4 million Muslims living in England. Right-wing terrorism poses a constant threat, with a far-right teenager found guilty of planning to murder Muslims at two mosques in England in March 2023. Unfortunately, some terrorists have been more successful, as was the case with Mohammed Salim, who was murdered in cold blood by Ukrainian neo-Nazi Pavlo Lapshin in April 2013. Another example was a terror attack near Finsbury Park Mosque in London, 2017. Islamophobe Darren Osborne drove a van into pedestrians, killing Makram Ali, again during the Islamic Holy Month. Despite these horrific murders, the UK government remains unwilling to find a working definition of Islamophobia. Critics suspect it's due to fear many of its party members would be found guilty of anti-Muslim prejudice.
Well, joining us today to talk about Islamophobia in the UK and elsewhere, we have Amar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He pre-worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. And Farah Kutena, originally from and raised in Al-Quds, from one of the last Palestinian families in the Old City. She is also the founder of Key 48, a campaign calling for the immediate right of return of all Palestinian refugees and a referendum amongst the global Palestinian community on the future of Palestine. Welcome to the show, both of you. Farah, let me come straight to you because you've been able to join me in the studio, which I appreciate. Just tell me, why are we seeing so much anti-Muslim hatred? And not only that, but it's boiling over to a proportion where people feel that it's okay to physically assault innocent Muslims in the street. Why is it getting that bad?
It's a culmination of multiple reasons. I think one of those reasons would be kind of the way in which Muslims have been depicted for the past few decades in TV series, in movies, in Hollywood, which we know has links to the CIA, kind of going along with any kind of US foreign policy that's fitting at the time. And then also we have within that culmination is British government policies, kind of prevent and other Islamophobic policies, and also kind of the attitudes of British governments at the time. You know, we know there's a rampant Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. We've had a Prime Minister, like, for example, Boris Johnson, who was extremely Islamophobic, never even really apologised, you know, let alone actually was held accountable for the Islamophobic remarks he made. And we know that there was a direct impact by those remarks. We know that his remark referring to Muslim women as letterboxes, as burglars, we know that Islamophobic attacks on Muslim women increased by over 300% just as a direct result of that single comment he made. So it's a culmination of many factors.
Amar, you're joining us over Skype, and again, welcome to the show. Just tell me, in your opinion, who's more to blame for this atmosphere of hostility towards Muslims? Do you think that it's just politicians who are to blame, or perhaps the media has a major role in causing this problem?
Well, I think it's definitely both. I mean, the British media, which of course includes print, broadcast and radio, has played and continues to play a very, very large role in stoking Islamophobia. And I think this is a very important question because the media, by and large, is an extension of the British state. So I think there's not really that clear-cut divorce between politicians and the British media. They kind of work in tandem with each other, particularly the government of the day. And the British state, of course, has been a pioneer of 21st century Islamophobia across the globe, particularly in the post-9/11 period. There's almost no media outlet in Britain that is not, at least doctrinally, an extension of the British state. There's no countercultural newspaper, television show, or radio program, really. And all of the media news outlets have dedicated liaison on staff that report to or are directly paid by the British security services in order to produce content directly for them. And similarly, defense correspondents are essentially embedded in the Ministry of Defense, regurgitating state propaganda. And on key issues of security policy, international policy, and of course, Muslims in Britain are a highly securitized community and of special interest as well in terms of international policy, there's very little that is produced in broadcast, print, and radio that's not directly generated by the state or that leans heavily on the state for both its line and its expert contributors. So I think they kind of work in tandem with each other.
But Ammar, there's also this kind of issue which is pushed. They're like conspiracy theories, misconceptions that have become quite popular in large parts of society. This idea that Muslims are the ones that are coming over here, trying to change the West, bringing their own religious practices, trying to basically a creeping Sharia. That's the idea that's being pushed around now. Do you think that there's where is this coming from? Why is this the issue that people look at Muslims with such mistrust?
I think the problem is because Britain is undergoing a huge identity crisis, and this isn't something new. This has been happening for decades. There's been a huge well of insecurity about Britishness in political discourse, and the reasons why Muslims have been attacked is because, you know, in the shadow of this declining British Empire, we've maintained our identity and they haven't, and they're confused about their identity. The decline of Christianity in particular has, I think, come as a shock to the values of society and to what people think Britain is conceptually. In the recent census, we saw that Britain really isn't any longer a Christian country. There's a huge amount of atheists and agnostic people here in Britain, but people still seem to think, well, we have our Christian cultural values, and these Muslims, these foreign barbarians are here to subvert our, you know, the beauty of Christendom. So I think it's primarily because Brits themselves are undergoing this identity crisis.
Let me come back to you, Farah, and just ask about the Islamophobia comes in different forms. There's obviously street thugs and right-wing terrorists who commit violent acts against Muslims directly. But there's also state-backed efforts which are deemed Islamophobic, like the Prevent Counter-Extremism Strategy, which is basically a government-backed initiative to try and root out extremism. But there seems to be an obsession with Muslims in this policy. Just tell us a little bit about Prevent and also your own personal experiences with this strategy.
Yeah, so Prevent is, you know, a counter-terrorism strategy, a wider strategy of another policy called Contest, and it's very relevant to point out this is a policy created and formed by the Conservative Party, a right-wing party. You know, it states that it's to target extremism, but actually it's an attempt by a right-wing government to purge its left-wing citizens. And what you'll find amongst the Muslim community in the UK is that they do sit on the left. They endorse kind of socialist policies. The Muslim community really gathered behind, for example, Jeremy Corbyn in his attempts to become prime minister as well. So really they've kind of exploited Prevent to target kind of a left-wing voting base, to criminalise kind of views such as being pro-Palestine, such as, many views, even, you know, being supportive of something like Black Lives Matter, and kind of all these views that do sit on the left of the political spectrum. And from my own personal experiences of Prevent, when I was at university, it was massively used to crush our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression, when it came to Palestine, but then also marginalising and criminalising kind of Muslim students' right to express their religion on campus. We had members of staff fulfilling their Prevent duty, which would involve them actually kind of turning Islamic prayer rooms into multi-faith rooms, destroying prayer mats, destroying Qurans as well.
Oh, wow.
Kind of just criminalising Muslim students on campus.
So basically, if you're a Muslim who perhaps expresses political views that are not in line with how the state's worldview, pro-Palestine sentiment, for example, I think I've even read reports of students who have accidentally said, "I live in a terrorist house," and it's been misinterpreted to mean a terrorist house. Then in comes Prevent, teachers report on students, and Muslim kids are basically treated like they're criminals or terrorists.
There was one notable case of a secondary school student. He was a Muslim student, and he was simply wearing a Free Palestine badge on his school uniform. And the police raided his house because teachers then reported him to Prevent using their duty.
Well, those are some very valid points you mentioned. But of course, Islamophobia isn't just a problem in the UK, but is prevalent in all non-Muslim nations around the world. Two particularly bad cases of state-sponsored Islamophobia can be found in India and France, as the following report explains.
The rise of nationalist politics and Hindu fundamentalism has led to the marginalization and discrimination of Muslims in India. The ruling BJP party in particular has been accused of discriminating against Muslims. In 2019, it passed the controversial Citizenship Amendment Act, which offered citizenship to non-Muslim refugees from neighboring countries while excluding Muslims. The law sparked widespread protests and condemnation from human rights groups and the international community. In the media, Muslims are often depicted as terrorists, criminals, and anti-national elements, which has contributed to the rise of hate crimes and vigilantism against Muslims. Muslims were also blamed for the spread of the COVID-19 virus and were subjected to discrimination and violence. Lynchings of Muslims have become more common, with mobs targeting individuals suspected of consuming or selling beef, which is considered sacred by Hindus. Muslims have also been excluded from employment opportunities and denied access to education and healthcare. Meanwhile, France has the largest Muslim population in Europe, with estimates suggesting that there are between 5 and 6 million Muslims living in the country. However, they're often subjected to discrimination, social exclusion, and hate crimes. The French government has a strict separation of church and state and has banned the wearing of religious symbols in public spaces, including the hijab, niqab, and burqa. The powerful far-right National Front Party, led by Marine Le Pen, has campaigned on an anti-immigrant and anti-Islam platform, using fear-mongering tactics to appeal to voters. The party has also been accused of promoting hate speech and inciting violence against Muslims. Daesh terror attacks in France have also contributed to Islamophobia. These attacks have led to a sense of fear and mistrust amongst the wider population, with Muslims being unfairly blamed and subjected to discrimination and hate crimes. In 2021, President Emmanuel Macron introduced a new law that aimed to combat so-called Islamist separatism and promote secularism. The law includes measures such as increasing oversight of mosques and Muslim organizations, as well as restrictions on homeschooling and the issuance of halal certificates.
So there you go, some prominent examples of blatant Islamophobia in other countries. Ammar, let me bring you back in on this. Now, of course, Islamophobia is a kind of European continent-wide epidemic and has been for quite some time. We've seen a rising trend in Quran burnings, for example, which has been defended. These are far-right protests, actions which have been defended by leaders of European countries, particularly in Scandinavia and elsewhere. And of course, in France, as we've seen, there seems to be a rise in anti-Muslim sentiment in the highest levels of political life there. Could you just tell us, are you concerned that what we're seeing in France and elsewhere could be the direction in which the UK is going in? And just how far will this go? I mean, it looks to me as if we could be returning to 1930s Europe, where minorities were put into concentration camps.
Well, I am very concerned, and certainly the example of India is very apposite in terms of what you just mentioned about the 1930s, given that the Hindutva ideology that the BJP subscribes to and the RSS movement takes great inspiration from Nazism and European race science in general. I think that, you know, as Islamophobia, as you say, is a European continent-wide phenomenon, it's also a global phenomenon. We do need to be concerned about the happenings in other countries. Of course, what's happening in those other countries isn't directly comparable. What's happening in France, for example, is very much related to the fact that it's, you know, a republic, whereas Britain's a constitutional monarchy. The republic sees itself as a vanguard that imposes its values on others. But we shouldn't ever be complacent about what happens there, because often what we see with these sorts of trends is that these tactics are almost battle tested in one area of the world, and then they end up expanding to another. Particularly in the European continent, we've seen trends in terms of legislation and banning and the liquidation of Islamic assets happening not just in France, but in Germany, in Austria, and in other European countries. So we should never be under the illusion that we aren't rapidly heading in that direction here in Britain. It's potentially dangerous and complacent to engage in a game of kind of relativized victimhood, because that will, as you've rightly mentioned, could end in, you know, a march to the death camps. Islamophobia is a global industry, a global problem, and we have to be very cautious about it in this society. Otherwise, who knows, we could be in the position of those Muslims in France or in India.
Farah, obviously there is a massive issue with this, and yeah, we could talk about different countries specifically, but one thing which I find very interesting is that there's this idea that Muslims who emigrate here and settle here, they should perhaps be grateful that they live in a country where they have perhaps a bit more freedoms than they do in countries like India, where there are purges against Muslims that take place in the streets. Not necessarily as bad as that here yet, but I think that there are some who would say to Muslims, well, you should be grateful, you should be more British as a result, you shouldn't be complaining so much. What's your response to that?
I think it's quite an outrageous, sentiment. There's nothing really that Muslims should be grateful for being here. I've witnessed my Muslim friends have female Muslim friends have had their hijabs torn off. You know, the rhetoric of Tommy Robinson has led to actions like these, and we see even just a few years ago these letters being posted around people's homes saying, you know, punish a Muslim day, and kind of offering points to harm Muslims.
Yes, those are just a few examples, but Amar, let me ask you about a specific phenomenon which has occurred recently. There's the rising Quran burnings in Europe. The reason I come back to this is because we saw a massive Muslim reaction to recent burnings which took place in Scandinavia. Turkey got involved. They vetoed a bid by Sweden to join NATO, and it turned into a massive political scandal. And some may argue that the Muslim reaction to that basically achieved some results. So what I want to ask you about is how Muslims should respond to incidents of Islamophobia in whatever form they take. Do you think we need more street protests? Do you think we need more Muslims in politics? What's the solution?
Well, I think that certainly we need more advocacy for Muslims, and we need more organization. I think one of the biggest reasons why Islamophobes, not just in Britain, but particularly in the Nordic countries, where there are even fewer Muslims than there are, you know, in Britain and other countries, is there's a lack of an institutional, organizational defense for Muslim communities. And that, because we don't have that, it means that there's no real deterrent for these would-be attackers. And when we did have those protests, or that it was effective. But these broad institutional failures among Muslims globally, that is what really has emboldened these enemies of Islam and Muslims to take these sorts of actions, which of course is encouraged by the rhetoric of various governments. The problem that we have in the Muslim community, that, you know, the Jewish community, for example, doesn't have, is we don't have a sort of structure of state-funded community defense organizations like the Community Security Trust, which is a lobbying group that's funded by the British government. There's no, you know, Muslim Shomrim. There's no organized community defense force. There are no legal organizations that lobby explicitly to protect Muslim interests. It's not even necessarily about Muslims going into politics. It's about Muslims having the capacity to be able to influence political change, which doesn't necessarily need to happen by people being elected to parliament. They can become lobbyists, and they can we can develop organizations that actually have clout politically. So I think we do have to come together to protect our communal interests, because the ones that exist at the moment, organizations in Britain, for example, like Tell Mama, have been so heavily subverted, in my view, and penetrated by agents of causes that are completely hostile to Muslims. So we don't really have any real advocacy organizations.
Farah, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think the solution is? Because as we've discussed in this show, there is many different types of Islamophobia. We have entire governments that are supportive of this viewpoint. And right now in the UK, they won't even define Islamophobia. There isn't even a government-recognised definition of the term Islamophobia. So we don't even know how to combat it if we can't even define it. So what do you mean? What's the solution?
I think the solution here is to put more kind of leaders of Muslim communities in positions of power and influence. So they're, you know, they're the ones really deciding kind of what policies are Islamophobic, what policies, you know, are harmful to the Muslim community. The likes of tokenism in regards to the Conservative Party, where they place these politicians who may be people of colour or maybe of a certain religion, but then still, you know, kind of implement the same harsh policies that their white counterparts would implement, isn't good enough anymore. We actually need representation behind those kind of token figures.
I'm going to bring it to you, Ammar. The same question to you. There is an issue with political representation, I think, because Hamza Youssef, the leader of the SNP now in Scotland, he's being criticised as to whether he's even a Muslim anymore because he's seen as compromising on his Islamic values to obtain that position. But what about the idea of if you are principled like Jeremy Corbyn and stand by your views, then you'll be denied the opportunity with the establishment turning on you to keep you out of positions of power. What do you think? Do you think that there's any chance of gaining any real political representation for Muslims in the West?
I do think it's very difficult if you're a practicing Muslim to become a politician of any influence in this country. And that's why now I'm primarily focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. And I think having, you know, strong communal organizations is one way in which Muslims can assert themselves, because, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, for example, who was seen by the security establishment in Britain as being politically Muslim because of his proximity to Muslim communities in Britain, you know, he was, as one data pointed out, a victim of Islamophobia in and of himself, and he wasn't even a Muslim. And you can see the way in which Muslims are attacked, because the aim of these individuals, people like Keir Starmer, for example, who are servants of the security establishment, is they want to, and they've been quite successful, actually, in ejecting Muslims from public life. And they're doing that at the behest of not only the security state here in Britain, but also at the behest of Zionist entrists who represent the interests of a hostile foreign regime. So my view is the current political situation is very difficult to be a practicing Muslim. We should be focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. Of course, that doesn't mean we give up on politics, but we also need to be realistic about the way in which the tide is flowing at this particular moment in time. And that's my personal view.
A very good point to end on. Thank you very much to both my guests. That's all we have time for on this edition of the show. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has said, America is a failing nation that is in decline. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, America and its economy are facing major challenges that could undermine Washington's position in the world. Former U.S. President Donald Trump told the National Rifle Association NRA convention in the state of Indiana recently. The Biden administration has pushed the country to the brink of collapse with both its foreign and domestic policies, Trump claimed, as he spoke about his ambitions for 2024 presidential campaign. The USA is a mess. Our country is crashing. Inflation is out of control. The former president stated the US dollar is crashing as well, he claimed, adding that the American currency will soon no longer be the world's standard. This would amount to Washington's greatest defeat in 200 years and was unthinkable just a few years ago, Trump said as he addressed the NRA convention in Indianapolis. The Biden administration's failures in the foreign policy field have seen Russia join forces with China. The former president said, adding that together with Iran, Moscow and Beijing have now formed a coalition. We have never been in such danger in our lives. I believe it is the most dangerous time in the history of our country, Trump said, noting that the Biden administration had been unable to avoid an escalation between Washington and Moscow, and the use of nuclear weapons is now being mentioned, including by other countries around the world. According to Trump, the current administration has done more damage to the U.S. than the five worst presidents in the country's history, although he did not identify the former leaders to whom he was referring. Trump, who has confirmed his intention to seek the Republican nomination for 2024 presidential election, vowed to make America great again if elected. He remains mired in several legal issues, however, including a criminal case relating to campaign finances. During his speech recently, Trump repeatedly described this prosecution as election interference instigated by the Democrats and maintains that his legal issues will not derail his bid to return to the White House. According to China Daily, economic reports are appearing that collectively raise a very large red flag about the state of U.S. economy. Could the U.S. economy be entering the kind of monumental collapse that occurs just once a century? By some accounts, it is simply too early to know whether the approaching downturn will be the kind of simple contraction that occurs every 4 years or is instead something far more serious. As noted by the Conference Board, the U.S. consumer spending has continued to support GDP growth despite the dual headwinds of rising interest rates and high inflation. At the same time, other reports have begun to appear that paints a very different picture of the overall economic performance of the U.S., and these data points are hard to overlook. Wage growth in the U.S. dropped for 20 straight months, taking place at a time of rising inflation. A long-standing and ongoing decline in worker wages is putting massive pressure on U.S. households. The squeeze have apparently triggered a wave of crime that some are calling jogging. As explained by commentator Michael Sinder, from coast to coast, predators are patiently watching potential victims and strike those victims when they're juggling their car keys or cell phones as they prepare to enter their cars. This report is certainly not enough to indicate a serious moment of stress on U.S. households, but there is more. Altogether, $450 trillion in income was siphoned away from U.S. workers between 1975 and 2018, due largely to the efforts of inflation. A massive and invisible decline in real wages was experienced by U.S. workers in the form of foregone income that went unnoticed by most U.S. families. The culminative hit experienced by U.S. households over this 44-year period has now reached the unimaginable level of $450 trillion. The upshot of this invisible creep is that many families in the U.S. have had to dip into savings or sell their homes just to cover the increasing cost of living. And worse, given their traditional work ethic, many U.S. citizens are blaming themselves for not making ends meet. The U.S. federal deficit grew by $249 billion in just 1 month. Andrew Duhrin of the Wall Street Journal has reported that the U.S. federal deficit grew by a record $249 billion last month, meaning on December 12, 2022. What this suggests is that the U.S. government is fast losing its ability to function as a lender of last resort and, as a result, may not be able to bail out its own citizens when a bailout is needed most. In addition, as the federal deficit widens in leaps and bounds, the U.S. Treasury will have to pay much higher coupon rates in order to attract international investors and induce them to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. This increase in coupon rates will further worsen the effects of inflation already being registered by U.S. households and promise that even higher interest rates will attach to future car loans and home purchase mortgages. This data point also confirms that the problem of rising interest rates appears to be accelerating. U.S. retail vegetable process increased by a whopping 38% in the month of October alone. In a report filed by Elizabeth Elkin of Bloomberg, water cuts by the government and storms were blamed for nearly 40% rise in the retail price of vegetables placed on homeowners between October 1st and November 1st. This number is not a small and presents further evidence that the pace of economic stress is accelerating and possibly bringing the U.S. closer to the onset of complete economic collapse.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Ardham, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Hello, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. I'm Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of taqlid. Sheikh Javed, in the last few episodes, we've been talking about the concept of taqlid, and you enlightened us, in fact, about this issue very much. I would like to ask you this question at the beginning of this episode, that does taqlid require any kind of formalities?
Well, that's a very good question, a great question. In fact, there are lots of people who do not, who continue to think that taqlid is an act of ibadah, it's an act of worship, and therefore one need to make a niyyah and to form his intention to do taqlid of a mujtahid. Well, the case is not. And that's not the case because taqlid requires no formality. There's nothing like niyyah in it.
Mm-hmm.
The religious authorities have said it clearly that if a person simply acts according to the fatwa of the most knowledgeable and the most qualified mujtahid,
yes,
that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing, there's no niyyah or, you know, there's no like something like making wuzu or preparing yourself for it or to follow a certain procedure. There's no such thing. To act according to the fatwa of the most qualified mujtahid is sufficient. And that's what the audience, the people, especially those in the Indian subcontinent, need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the problem with Indians and some Shia Muslims who live in those countries, because they think that, okay, taqlid has certain formalities and certain procedures which we must learn, but that's not the case.
Shastavid, what about discovering who the best qualified and knowledgeable mujtahid is, you know, in this regard? Like, do we have to know, like, by reading some books and this and that, you know, to know about, for example, who is the qualified religious scholar that we have to follow?
You're right.
In order to select?
You as an ordinary person cannot cannot identify the most qualified mujtahid.
That's the because, point, because yeah. normally we don't know about the religious
you don't know.
Because, duties and responsibilities.
Because you should have the capacity.
Yes.
As long as you're not a mujtahid yourself or you're not a student of religion,
mm-hmm.
like a jurist,
yes.
you do not have the actually, you're not qualified to identify the most qualified mujtahid.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are a scholar, of course, you know, you can read his books, his works. You can associate with him. You can engage in a discussion with him. And at the end of the day, you will come to know that he is actually qualified. He is qualified. And this is one of the ways through which you can identify the most qualified mujtahid. Of course, if there are two witnesses who are also from the mm-hmm. scholars of Islamic jurisprudence,
yes.
and they bear witness, they testify to the effect that, okay, a certain mujtahid, for example, is the most qualified mujtahid, then also that's enough. You can you should act according to that shahada or testimony.
Mm-hmm. What about the books of catechism, like the Tawzi al-Masail, which are available in the Muslim-dominated countries? Can we rely on the fact that because there are like Tawzi al-Masail,
no,
then
that's not a proper way. And the book of Tawzi al-Masail or the Islamic laws does not indicate and does not suggest that the mujtahid is qualified, because we have some scholars who have printed and published their books of Islamic laws, and it does not mean that he is actually qualified, you know. We have many scholars, many fuqaha, but we need to follow the most qualified of them, the best of them, the most eligible of them, the most learned of them. And of course, in while trying to identify, we need to consult the other scholars, other jurists. And if it's not possible to identify him through such means or through such procedures which I mentioned, then we should see as to which jurist, which faqih is better known
mm-hmm.
As qualified.
Right.
For example, who is more well-known, who is more mm-hmm. popular across the world, okay?
I see.
And that can give you a hint to help you come to a conclusion somehow that, okay, he is probably the most, otherwise he should not have been very much popular or very much well-known among the Shia Muslims. Okay.
Okay.
So that can be another sign of someone's being knowledgeable or the most knowledgeable.
I see. Thank you very much, Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back after the break to continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad Hossein. This program, I'm Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic is still taqlid, the rules of taqlid, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, will one be considered a sinner if he or she is careless in learning the religious issues, rules, that he or she frequently encounter?
Of course, if his, let's say, carelessness or his, you know, his carefreeness, I may term it, in learning the religious rules and obligations leads to leaving or forsaking an obligation or committing a haram act, he will be a sinner. And negligence is not negligence. There is something that leads to a sin. And if a person deliberately neglects his duty to learn the religious laws, he will end up falling into a sin. It is necessary, it is mandatory for every duty-bound person to try to learn what his duty and his obligations are, okay? For example, if you are a businessman, for Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam said, Al-fiqh thumma al-matjar. He repeated this three times, Al-fiqh thumma al-matjar. So as a businessman, it is very much essential that you do whatever possible to learn the rules of business, the rules of exchanging goods, the rules of buying and selling things. Because if you don't learn, if you don't know what you are supposed to do and how you conduct yourself while engaging in a business, you might end up, you know, receiving usury or selling haram money. Things, earning haram things, like, for example, buying, selling means of gambling or, you know, entertainment, songs and things like that, you know, usury. So there are many things which are haram to acquire. So it's very important for every individual to try to learn what he is frequently, he usually frequently encounters in his day-to-day life.
Right.
Yes. So prayer is the most important thing, duty which every individual, without any exception, every sensible and rational agent must
say the prayer.
Must learn and must say the prayer correctly. You know, if he does not know the rule, he should immediately try to learn. If his pronunciation is, for example, is weak, he should jump into action and learn it and improve his pronunciation.
Right.
And the same is the case with fasting, with Hajj, with Zakat, with Khums, and there are many other mandatory religious Islamic duties which we are which we frequently encounter in our day-to-day lives.
Thank you very much. Doing things is one thing, but doing them efficiently based on religious, in fact, decisions is another. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.